It's all right if I move this. Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Cheers.
My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987, and thank you for asking me to come do this. I've been here before, and God, Andrew did such a nice job as attendance. It would be a hard act to follow, but anyway... My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987. My last drink was on February 4th, 1987, into the morning of February 5th, 1987. And another little interesting fact to me, maybe not to anybody else, is that I haven't had a drink since February 4th of 87. I also haven't eaten a pickled egg since February 4th of 1987. I just never, with a sober mind, ever looked at a jar of green goop with hard-boiled eggs floating around in them and thought, man, that looks appetizing. Takes about a dozen beers to think, God, I'm hungry, and grab at one of those. And I'm so glad that Sean and Frank made it. They came up from, they live in West Hollywood, so... I am going to speak a little slower and not use any big words tonight so they can enjoy the meeting also. I just found something out, and I have to say this because I haven't heard this. I just heard this the other day, and maybe everybody knows except me, the story of my life. But did you know that they discontinued Bacardi 151 rum? I guess like 5 years ago. Apparently too many people were like blowing up, you know, igniting from smoking cigarettes and drinking 151. And it's like, I feel bad for the new people, you know. I mean, you guys missed out. I wasn't a big rum drinker. I was more, beer was my thing, and gin was my second thing. But I did my share of Bacardi 151. My last Bacardi 151 drunk was right around Christmas of 1985. And I was at this friend of mine's house, childhood friend. We'd all gathered since it was Christmas, and there was like 10 of us. And these guys were like Who, the band Who fanatics, some of them. So they're like playing guitars and singing The Who, and I'm just downing Bacardi. And next thing I know, I come to on the floor. I was sitting in a chair, and then I come to on the floor in my underwear, and there's like five or six guys scattered around this apartment on the floor, also passed out. Greg Matsuda was about 8 feet away from me. They're all fully clothed. I'm the only one in my underwear. Greg Matsuda's about 8 feet away from me, and I see, I'm kind of looking sideways, and Doug Lindstrom pops up and runs to the bathroom, obviously had to vomit, and he kicked Greg in the head on the way, and I thought to myself, he deserved that, you know, somehow I thought he did. But the reason I mentioned that, was told later by one guy, he said, I was sitting there, I was talking to two girls, my vocabulary, you couldn't understand a word I was saying. I was just mumbling at these two girls in an attempt to go somewhere. Apparently, if you mumble at them long enough, you know. And then I just fell out of the chair onto the floor and passed out and started vomiting. So he took my clothes off and washed it for me. And anyway, no big deal. The point of this story is Doug Lindstrom, who I grew up with, drinking with, is that was the last time I drank 151 with Doug Lindstrom. I went to Doug Lindstrom's funeral about 15 years ago when he died of chronic alcoholism. And when I say died of chronic alcoholism, I don't mean car wrecks or a heroin overdose or anything else that people might say are alcohol related. He died from internal bleeding as a result of melting his insides from alcohol. And at his service, I had to show a family member of Doug's wife how to feed her beer through the service to keep her from going into DTs at the service, because she also was a drinker. So anyway, I was just thinking about that. It's like, boy, that was a lot of fun back then, wasn't it? You know? Anyway, so I drank for 11 years. fairly short period of time, but for whatever reason, my alcoholism progressed very rapidly. In those 11 years, I had a lot of consequences. I had a bunch of DUIs, drunk driving charges, 3 DUI convictions, treatment centers, hospitalized for alcohol withdrawal, hospitalized for alcohol poisoning, was a daily drinker from the beginning of my drinking up till the end of my drinking, where I became a daily oblivion drinker, somebody that was drinking to unconsciousness or blackout on a daily basis. And I could not turn it off, and I could not reverse it. Because as you read in chapter 3 before the meeting, which I really love, I got sober in a group that read that before the meeting, is the great obsession for every alcoholic is that somehow, someday, we will learn to control and enjoy our drinking. Now, my great obsession was not to control it, per se. I never wanted to be a social drinker. I never have had an interest in drinking like 3 or 4 drinks and calling it good. What I had an interest in was being able to drink a certain amount of alcohol and capture that magic that a certain amount of drinks brought, and the miracle that that did for me, and cut it off there and maintain it and not overdo it. I wanted to reverse, go back to a time where when I first started drinking, my first love of alcohol was Colt 45 malt liquor. And when I could drink 2 quarts of Colt 45, that was heaven. My late sponsor, Cliff Roach, used to call it the 8 minutes. That at some point in your drinking, there's an 8-minute period where everything is just okay. And Cliff went on to say that he literally almost gave away his entire life for those 8 minutes. And that's exactly what I did. Because see, when I wasn't drinking, when I was sober, not by our definition of sobriety, but when I was sober, I was riddled with all sorts of neurosis. Now, I don't want to show it to you, but the main one is I was terrified. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of people. I was afraid of my own feelings and my own emotions. I was afraid of my thoughts. Now, on the outside, you would see me and you'd think, you know, you wouldn't think that. I would try to portray myself as a tough guy or, you know, certainly not afraid. I was a frightened little human being, and I could not assimilate with other people. No matter what I did, what I wore, what I achieved in life, I could never bridge that gap and cross over that invisible barrier that separated me from the rest of the human beings. The only time I ever got close to it was after 8 to 10 drinks. 8 to 10 drinks, I could cross over there and start to mix with those people and feel a little bit comfortable. When I wasn't drinking, I also was somebody that I was just, in addition to the fear, I had this constant low-grade anxiety when there was no reason for the anxiety. I had, and it was peppered with moments of pure anxiety attacks. I was diagnosed once before I got sober by this anxiety expert, and he started I have social anxiety, I am agoraphobic, I have situational anxiety, and some other phobias. And he was like puzzled as he's doing. He goes, you know, usually people fall into one category, and he goes, you kind of seem to have it all. But anyway, I was plagued with this anxiety when there was no catalyst to have anxiety, and I was plagued with depression, may be too harsh of a word. I lived with kind of this constant state of malaise. I just didn't feel right. In fact, my mantra when I was drinking was, on the days I was sober, I would be like, I know I drink too much, but there's something else wrong with me. There's something really wrong with me. I don't know what it is. And I just felt like an alien on a foreign planet, and alcohol saw that. I felt like an alien on a foreign planet in my own family. I was a black sheep in my own family. I mean, And rightfully so, to some extent. I mean, my dad played in the NFL, and he played pro baseball. My brother played 10 years in the major leagues, and I went to jail 16 times for alcohol-related arrests. So I really was the black sheep, in addition to feeling like the black sheep. But anyway, those 8 to 10 drinks were absolutely magic. I could go over that line and participate in life in a way that I never was able to without that alcohol. And the reality is, if I was somebody that could drink 8 to 10 drinks and then maintain what those 8 to 10 drinks did for me by nursing number 10 or nursing number 11, I never would have come here. In fact, tonight, I'd be out drinking my 8 to 10 drinks because it worked. It not only works so well that, you know, in AA, we talk about this sense of impending doom. I get that, but mine was more of a sense of impending insanity. I felt like I was right on the edge, and it seemed as though alcohol was the thing keeping me from going completely over the edge, that if I didn't drink, I was just going to, you know, go totally insane. Anyway, so because of that phenomenon of craving, I couldn't stop and maintain, and I would drink uncontrollably. I'd drink to unconsciousness. I'd drink to blackout. Sometimes I did pitiful and incomprehensible demoralizing things. Other times I just drank till I was unconscious and would come to morally bankrupt, full of guilt, shame, remorse, sick, swearing, I'll never do that again. Or earlier in my drinking, I would come to and say, it happened again. How did it happen? I didn't mean to get that drunk. And anyway, so I grew up in Portland, Oregon, the suburbs of Portland, Oregon, and grew up in a fairly kind of middle to upper middle class area that I went to private college prep schools. And in this private prep school, we drank very similar to the way that people drink in the Greek system at colleges. We had keggers every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I was at all of them. I was a daily drinker all through high school. I wrecked my first car before I had my driver's license drunk. And I was a runaway, but I was not a very successful runaway. I would get drunk, run away, drive to Idaho, and sober up, feel guilty, and drive home. And did that multiple times. Rolled a couple cars drunk in high school. Got my first DUI. Had several other issues with the law, all behind alcohol. And ultimately was kicked out of that high school. And I knew that there was something wrong with me in addition to the fact that I drank the way I drank. And I thought what it was is this upper middle class prep school stuff is what the issue is. These just aren't my people. And if I was to move to rural Oregon and become a logger, that would solve my problem because those are my people. Because these people aren't. These people have to be. So that's what I did. And so I became a logger, and I was a logger for a while. And I'll tell you, at the ripe age of 18, Jeff Sevitz, my first logging boss, took me aside and said, and I know every profession says, oh, there's a lot of drinkers. You know, us school teachers really tie it on. But believe it or not, loggers actually do drink quite a bit, and as well as other professions like that. And I stood out as an 18-year-old, amongst a group of people, all 10 years my senior, as the drunk. And Jeff Sevitz, my logging boss, took me aside and told me, I have a problem, you're a lush, etc. I always kind of in hindsight think back, it's like, well, if Jeff, when I made amends to this guy, because I had embezzled some money from the company also while I worked there, and he was so glad I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. He, you know, this is years later, you know, a good 10 plus years after I worked for him. He's like, my wife and I are always so worried about you, Chris. We're very familiar with alcoholism. We have family members that are in AA. And we were always so worried about you. You're so grateful you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about that afterwards. It's like, if you were so concerned about me, Jeff, then why would once a week, religiously, after work, you'd say on the ride home with all the other loggers, you'd say, Chris, do you want to come over tonight and do some data entry? And I'd say, no, I'm really tired tonight, Jeff, I can't do it. I'll pay you time and a half. No, Jeff, I can't, I'm beat. I'll pay you time and a half and buy you a case of beer. Okay. Every week, you know. Because at 18, you know, a free case of beer, that's a big deal. Anyway, so I did that for a while and, you know, continued having problems. I'm a daily drunk by this time and on into my 20s. I did another geographic, and I ultimately tried college. I went to college. I made it in college. Two terms. At the end of the two terms, I hadn't made it to a single class. I was kicked out of campus housing, had a restraining order on me from campus housing by the director of campus housing, Joe Fisher, who becomes important later in my story. And allegedly, they had a picture of me in campus security that said, do not approach alone, he is dangerous. And anyway, so that was, did I bring my water up here?
No.
Thank you. Anyway, that was the way I lived my life. After that little thing, I moved into an apartment that was kind of a skid row of my own design, and I just drank to oblivion on a daily basis. In the fall of 1985, I surrendered to the fact that I was an alcoholic. And I don't mean recovery. I just gave up trying to be like them. I gave up trying to hold a job, hold it together, look like them, talk like them, be responsible in society. And I was just like, you know what? I'm a drinker, and I'm going to drink. And I'm going to drink as much as I want, whenever I want. Next 3 weeks, I drank to blackout on a daily basis. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I thought, I wonder if I'm going to ever be able to slow this down. And my next thought was, I don't care, because this is the freest I've ever been in my life. And that lasted a few more weeks, and then pretty soon the consequences stacked up, and I'd crossed over an invisible line where I was drinking to oblivion on a daily basis, and I could not shut it off. I couldn't pull it back. I tried everything. I tried quitting. I tried controlling. I tried taking substances to replace it. And, you know, the problem with drugs for me, and I'm a big advocate for singleness of purpose because I think identification is so critical, and it's the one thing we have all in common. But the thing is the drugs got me high, and getting high was fun, no question about it. But alcohol got me there, and my life was dependent upon me getting there. So drugs didn't work, psychiatry didn't work, geographics didn't work, self-help books didn't work. I tried all this stuff and just continued to drink that way. And it was this Groundhog Day. Summer of 1986, I ended up in a detox, pumped full of Librium for a bunch of days in a row to get through the withdrawals. I went to a 28-day inpatient treatment center. I learned about alcoholism. I was taken to AA meetings, NA meetings, CA meetings, and I never identified. And the reason I never identified in any of those meetings is because there just wasn't a primary purpose in any of the meetings I went to. They were what we referred to back then as issue and tissue meetings, where you talked about issues and, you know, you blotted your tears with tissues. And I desperately didn't want to drink, but I didn't hear the message in AA. And anyway, so, you know, I started drinking soon after that. And see, I have time to set. Okay, Sean wanted me to tell this story. It's kind of stupid, but like I said, they're from West Hollywood, you know. Forgive them. But anyway, just to give you an illustration of my life at this time, because this was the darkest, absolutely most despairing time of my life. I suffered from a loneliness all my life. And all of this progressed as my drinking progressed. The anxiety, the discomfort, the loneliness. But this loneliness, it's difficult to articulate. It is such a hollow, empty, lonely feeling, and it has nothing to do with being alone. In fact, it's more painful if I'm amongst people, and it's even more painful if those people happen to be family. And I was just living this bleak life. I could no longer hold a job. I could go like 3 weeks and I'd blow up and, you know, and couldn't do it. So August of 1986, I'm working for Far Brothers Logging, and I get really hammered one night, and you know, and I'm talking, my drinking was, I started drinking beer from the time we left the woods. I made them stop at the first tavern an hour later to buy more cases of beer. We stopped in another town. This is over a two-hour stretch, the commute out into where we're logging. We stopped at a bar. We went into the bar. I bought pitchers of whiskey sours, and I drank everybody on that logging crew unconscious except for one guy. 10 guys passed out at the table except for me and one guy, and then I had to drive the crew home. I drove the crew or back to the shop. The owner of the logging company wouldn't let me drive home, so he had this other guy's girlfriend come get me and take me home with them. We bought a case of Rainier, what we called Rainier Pounders, 16-ounce Rainier beers. I drank those until I had to catch that crummy to go back out and start work again the next morning. And that day, I was like, I will never do this again, ever, you know, like I had many times before. And I did exactly the same thing again, as always, except for the next day when I came to, I was like, I made a commitment that I would never do this again. So I quit my job, and I drove to 7-Eleven, and this is in Oregon. They don't serve alcohol until 7 a.m. I waited for the store to open at 7 a.m., still half drunk from the night before, bought a case of beer, headed 300 miles down to Ashland, Oregon. Along the way, I picked up two hitchhikers who ended up being LSD salesmen. And these guys were sampling their own product. Well, apparently my driving was erratic because, or they were hallucinating, one of the two. But they were freaking out, and it was a truck. I'm in a pickup, and there's only a bench seat, so they're next to me. We get down to Ashland, and I'm out of beer, and I pull up to my favorite tavern down there called Cook's Tavern, and I pull up right in front in the no parking zone, and I say, hey, I got to run in here real quick. I'm going to leave the truck running. If the cops come to ticket me, just move it around the block. I'll be right back. So, you know, I went in, drank a pitcher of beer, truck's gone, guy, you know, the LSD salesmen are gone, and I call the cops. Cops come and get me, and they say, hey, Chris, you're in luck. We actually, you know, got these guys. We pulled them over right in front of the cop shop. And I was like, oh, good, you know. So they pull up, and they're in one car, and then one car and the other car, and they said, these guys said you told them that you could move the car. And I said, yes. And they said, well, we can't arrest them then. You gave them permission. I said, yeah, it's around the block, not 2 miles. And they said, well, we can't do anything about it. And I said, okay, whatever. You know, thinking, okay, we're done. But you, on the other hand, you have the right to remain silent, blah, 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 throw me in jail. And they threw me in jail for a warrant for like a $27 parking ticket or something really stupid, right? And I said, are you kidding? I'm going to spend the day in jail for like a $27 fine? And they said, you can either sleep it off in a holding cell on this $27 ticket, or we can give you a DUI, your choice. Anyway, so I went to jail, and I just hit a bottom. You know, I fought with cops. I'd spew obscenities, throw punches, do all this stuff. And the only thing that ever gave me was just legendary beatings, you know, on me from the police, which I deserved. But I took some pretty good hits. And I never really got the best of them. But anyway, I fought with them. I sat down on that hard little cot in jail, and I was done. So I took the sheets off of the little single bed that's in there, and I took them and I wrapped them up and formed a rope, and I tied a noose out of this. And then the toilets, for those of you that have been holding cells, they're not standard height toilets, at least the ones in Oregon weren't. They're about 8 inches lower to the floor. And I'm almost 6'3". And I thought was I'll tie this and I'll hang myself from that toilet. It didn't give me a lot of leverage because the drop was only about this much between the toilet seat and the floor. So it'd have to catch quick. And I couldn't engineer it correctly. It kept coming undone, you know. So that didn't work. And I went through this whole thing, you know, this whole bottom. And you'd think that you wouldn't think, other people would, you know, that I would go off and do something and, you know, go find help or whatever. The minute they let me out, I was like, I'm off to this place called Jasmine's, this bar, to drink, because not only am I drinking, but I've got a story, you know? And anyway, so there's that story, and just wasted about 8 minutes of my time of recovery on that. But anyway, that wasn't a unique story. That was just kind of, that happened, stuff like that, over and over and over. Fall of 1986, I did a geographic to Alaska. I found an ad for a dry logging camp in Alaska. I thought, that's the answer. I'll move to an island in southeast Alaska that's dry. I'll dry out and put this whole alcoholism thing behind me. So I flew up, went to work on Hecata Island, an hour and a half float plane ride from the nearest tavern, liquor store, grocery store that carried beer, and went there to dry myself out and solve my alcohol problem. 3 weeks in, hadn't had a drink, and these two new guys came into camp. They were in my bunkhouse, and one night after work, or they're probably their first night, because they had smuggled a bottle of whiskey in, and they popped the top. It was fall, like October, because we were watching the World Series, and they each took a little nip off the bottle, and they turned to me and they said, you want a drink? Now, my whole reason to be in Alaska was to solve my alcoholism. But when they said those magic words, do you want a drink? My mind said, you know, I'm probably not an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink for 3 weeks. I didn't go through the DTs or the withdrawals this time. I haven't really thought much about drinking. I haven't craved it. Probably, you know, probably not an alcoholic. Sure, I'll take a drink. Took the bottle, I tipped it up, and I went gunk, 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 and they grabbed it from me, and they said, hey, we're going to make this last. I thought we were going to kill this bottle between the three of us. Their intention was to bring a bottle of, like, whiskey to take a little sip off of or a little belt off of each night after work. So what happened to me is, as an alcoholic, I had the equivalent of probably about a straight shot and a half of whiskey in me, with absolutely no possible means of getting another drink. And as an alcoholic who suffers from this craving, every cell in my being wanted another drink. So, of course, you know, the next float plane, which was like 12 hours away, that came into camp, I'm on it, into Ketchikan, into the forecastle snake pit drinking. And by this time, my tolerance level had fallen, where I would sometimes go into a blackout after only four or five drinks, where I used to have a huge tolerance. Now it was really unpredictable. Sometimes I'd drink, you know, a bunch of drinks, and I was physically drunk, but my mind was clear as a bell. And other times, I'd have four or five drinks, blackout. It was all over the place. This was one of those nights. Next thing I know, I'm crawling behind the forecastle in the alley. Next thing, I'm at the airport being chased by the cops. They tackle me in the airport, and I'm thrown in jail one more time. Whole story about that I don't have time to go into, thanks to Sean. And and I came to in this holding cell with two other guys. It was a single bed and a bunk bed. I was on the bottom bunk of the bunk bed, and when I came to in the morning, the guy on the top bunk was hanging over, looking at me, and he said, well, he didn't say anything, he was just kind of looking at me, and I opened my eyes to this guy, and I said, you know, can I help you? And he said, hey, my name's something, something, I've got 30 days sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm in here doing an amends because my sponsor made me come due 10 days of jail time I owed. And I was like, oh my God, I can't even get away from these AA people in here. Because despite the fact that I never identified in AA, I had a handful of them chasing me around and calling me. But anyway, that was the beginning of a series of coincidences that led me into Alcoholics Anonymous. From there, I left Ketchikan, I came down back to the lower 48, went to Portland, drank, did 22 days on my own without drinking, blew it at 22 days, went on a major bender, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, day after day. January of 1987, I'm doing 8 days of jail time for my third DUI. This is in the 80s. You didn't get in much trouble for DUIs. In fact, you had to work to get a DUI. I'd been pulled over in the 80s drunk driving so many times where it was dump the liquor out, be careful on your way home, or let the other guy drive. Now, it's like social drinkers get DUIs. I mean, they have a half a sip of, it's like, oh, you know, DUI. But you really had to work to get them back then. And I ended up with 3 convictions. And I owed 8 days of jail time for that 3rd conviction. And I was doing it on weekends in January of 87. Desperately not wanting to drink, yet on the weekdays when I was out of jail, drinking daily. And between the 3rd and the 4th weekend, I got arrested midweek for some sort of alcohol-related offense. It may have been a violation of that restraining order because it was on campus housing in Ashland, Oregon. I don't know what it was for. I just remember the 2 guys I was with, the cops, there was a total overreaction. I mean, the cops swarmed us. We hadn't done anything. The 2 guys I was with ran, and back there was this, like, back then you could buy these suitcases of Ham's beer. I think there were like 48 beers. And I had one of those. I picked the suitcase of beer up before I ran, so I got caught. Because I'm not just going to run with my beer there. And anyway, I got arrested. And when I was arrested, these guys lectured me. And they said, you know, Chris, you got a real problem with alcohol. And you should go see this guy, Joe Fisher, head of campus housing at Southern Oregon State University. The guy that put the restraining order on me. You should go see him. He's an expert on alcoholism. I dismissed that. The next day, I'm walking down the street, and there's one of these sidewalk preachers that's reading stuff out of the Bible. He reads something as I come by. Somehow, it seemed to correlate with what the cops had said about going and seeing this guy, Joe Fisher. And when he said that, and I put that together, I thought, oh, you know what? If I was one of these people that believed in God, I would think, like, this is the hand of God at work in my life, giving me a message or inspiration to go actually see this guy, Joe Fisher. Now, I took a few more steps, and I had a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity was this. What if, for once in my life, I don't dismiss that stuff as being stupid, trivial, and even though I don't believe in it, I act on it and go see Joe Fisher anyway? This is long before I ever heard the terminology act as if. I thought, yeah, what do I have to lose? I want to quit drinking. My plan was to go to the Schick Center. You know, 10 days, a couple 2-day follow-ups, and you're done. Alcoholism over. I thought, maybe this guy's a graduate of the Schick Center. And I went up. He wasn't. He took me, you know, he told me a story, asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting with him that night, reluctantly, but I went. And they saved my life. And the reason they saved my life is this. Because I've been to many AA meetings where they seemingly talked about everything other than alcoholism. And this, when I walk in, you know, Ashland, Oregon is a, like, if anybody knows it, the history of it, Haight-Ashbury in the 60s and early 70s in the hippie movement, when Haight-Ashbury blew up, all the hippies moved up to Mendocino County to communes. Then that blew up. Then they all moved up into Southern Oregon, into Ashland and Cave Junction and those areas. So these guys that were in, the guys being men and women in this meeting, these were like all ex-hippies that had done every substance under the sun, trust me. But they focused on the one thing we had in common, and that was alcoholism. And the speaker got up and she told her story. And then participants afterwards started telling their story. And somewhere in the middle of the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. And that was, I identified. Little by little, I found myself nodding. And then there was this one guy in the participation part where he stood up and he said, he talked about coming out of a blackout with a revolver in his mouth. And then he went back into the blackout and came to the next morning on the floor with a revolver next to him. And when he said that story, it gave me goosebumps because I had a very, very similar story. I had come out of a blackout one night, and I was holding a big carving knife on myself. And I went back into the blackout, and I came to the next day, and with the knife on the floor, and I had not only done that, but I had knifed to death all the furniture in this house and broke every dish and glass in this house and broke the front door down in this house, which I was a guest in. And... And so, you know, one more time, the police are called, etc. But anyway, the point with that whole story is I thought I was the only one that did these. These were my secrets, that I would come out, that I would try to hang myself from a toilet, that I would come out with this knife. I wasn't suicidal. Why was I doing that? Why did I do it? I thought I was the only one. And here was a guy that drank the way I drank, thought the way I thought, felt the way I felt, and had done similar things. And yet I thought I was the only person that wasn't institutionalized that did those things. So I came out of that meeting with a seed of hope, knowing that these people were like me and they were staying sober. I drank for one more week, and on February 4th of 87, I had a plan one more time that I was going to beat the game. The plan was I was going to drink 10 drinks, shut it down by 10 or 11 o'clock that night, come home from the bars, get a good night's sleep, and be like a regular person. Not that I hadn't attempted that like 100 times, you know, already in 1,000 other ways, but somehow I thought tonight would be the night that I would do that. I bought a short case of beer to drink on the way down to the bars with the guy that was going to come pick me up. He was running late, and I drank 9 of them sitting there waiting for him to come pick me up to go drink my 10 drinks. So I kind of blew my plan before I even left the house. I went down. I remember ordering vodka Collins, and I had one hand over one eye because I was seeing double. And then I went into a blackout, in and out. I came to at Cook's Tavern again, and the next thing I know, I'm assaulting the bartender. Apparently, he had cut me off, so I assaulted him, you know, the natural thing to do. Cops are called. I'm running through people's backyards. Cops catch me, and they're standing there saying whatever they say to us. They hadn't cuffed me yet. No big deal. Been in so much more significant trouble than this night, and yet something inside of me just broke, and I was done. I just... defeated. I was defeated. I would always spew obscenities. I would always fight with the cops. I just started weeping. They cuffed me. They put me in the car. They took me down. They processed me. I cried all through the processing to such an extent that one of the officers said, "Chris, we've never met, but you're not living up to your reputation because, you know, I was just beat." They took me home after they processed me. They didn't keep me overnight, dropped me off. I lay down in that bed, and my last conscious thought was this: something's different about tonight. I wonder if I'll feel this way in the morning. And when I came to in the morning, it was different. And what was different is I was beat. I was defeated by alcohol. Death was a more attractive alternative than continue living the way I was living. And I wasn't afraid of dying. What I was afraid of, I mean, if I had a crystal ball that I could have looked into that said, if you just drink for another year, you'll be dead, I would have just drank myself to death. What I was terrified of is that I would live another 5 years like this, or another 10 years like this. And in that desperation, I cried out to a God I didn't believe in or didn't want to believe in, and I said, please make this stop or kill me. And then I said a prayer that I had learned from my childhood religion, and I didn't know this at the time, but I became willing to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because that one meeting where they had created an atmosphere of identification, and there was such a small window to grab me. I didn't even want to be there, knowing that AA wasn't the solution. But in that small window, because they maintained those traditions and didn't go off on wild tangents about other things, they got me. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became willing to do all the things that they were doing despite what I thought about them, because some of the stuff I thought that they were doing seemed hokey and didn't make sense. There was a whole bunch of actions that weren't relevant to what I thought my problem was. I ended at 9:15, right?
9:13, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Okay. At 9:13, you'll give me 2 minutes. Okay. Minus 1 minute because of this exchange. And I started doing it. And I didn't know this, but the obsession to drink alcohol that I lived with on a daily basis for a long time was gone. On February 4th, 1987, I had an obsession to drink alcohol every day. And on February 5th, the obsession was gone, and it's never come back. I'm 37 plus years sober. It's never come back, and I believe in part for several reasons. One, because of that initial surrender, and two, because of all of the actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have done since then. And since I am at, I only have 4 or 5 minutes left, I'm just going to fast forward through several things, really meaningful, critical things in my story that I came prepared to share with you that Sean has robbed you of. And, typical self-centered alcoholic, and I keep coming back. Several things for the new person. Corey, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in this program, I've become a person that I never thought I could be. And I'll tell you this. When I did my fourth and fifth step, something inside of me changed, and I've never been the same person. And I didn't do it. All I wanted purely was physical sobriety. If that's all I would have ever gotten out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have considered that an absolute bargain. However, I found that in addition to physical sobriety, the same actions that expelled that obsession to drink alcohol, even though they didn't make sense, also changed me and made me a person who became comfortable in my own skin. Somebody who never had self-esteem got self-esteem. I've never worked on self-esteem. I've never worked on anything other than Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through the transformative powers of God, who I came to believe in, by taking actions as if I believed. I used to sit in meetings and go, God, I wish I could believe like these people, but I don't. But I found that all I had to do is act as if I believed in God to make a start in this program. And through that, I formed a relationship with the God of my own understanding, and I changed. And I've done all sorts of remarkable things. And I'm just going to say this. So how I got sober, I'm going to give some juice to intuitive thoughts. And intuitive thoughts and inspiration. Because Alcoholics Anonymous to me is not just attending meetings and having 18 service commitments and going to the restaurant and going to bowling and to the barbecue. That's the fellowship. And it's good, and it's critical. But the thing that changed me, the transformation, the transformative power in Alcoholics Anonymous came through living this and working the steps. And part of that is following intuitive thoughts. And intuitive thoughts to me never come with a neon sign saying, this is an intuitive thought from God. You better go and do this. They come obscured. And I question him. It's like, is that an intuitive thought? I don't know. Am I just manufacturing that? I go through this whole thing like this. But here's what I'm going to tell you. When I walked down the street, Monty, the sidewalk preacher, read that little thing, and then I, out of nowhere, had a thought. Even though I don't believe in this, what if I do go see this guy, Joe? And that led me to a meeting of you people that I identified in, which led me to sobriety. And through intuitive thoughts, I've gotten into the business I'm in. I've been married for 31 years. I'm not relationship material. It truly is God doing for me what I cannot do for myself. The business I'm in, everything about me is as a result of following God direction and a God-centered way of life. And I'll end with this. Chuck Chamberlain used to say this, and it's true for me. I have two choices. I can live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or I can live a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me.